session number 17117, reel 11.
Mr. Corker, reel 11.
Yes, the installations, the name of which escapes me, some Balikpapan something or other. But I remember we went down with the carriers, and there was the feeling, very much as we had in Britain, that we are now at last getting on top of things. And, I can remember the night before the airstrikes took off, trying to sleep on the upper deck, and, a beautifully calm sea and a starlit night and tropical and sort of thing, and looking up. And it's only at sea in wartime, when things are completely blacked out, that you realise how light stars can be, and you look at the heavens and the grandeur of the Milky Way and this sort of thing. Anyway, attack was carried out, and carried out successfully, and everyone felt satisfied, and we turned back and went back to Trincomalee. And back in Trincomalee, the routine looked as if it was going to be much the same, that, oh dear, one again of boredom, of just hanging around till something occurs, and which again was alien to what we'd been doing before. But then we had a signal that we're going to escort the Duke of Gloucester to Australia, because he was going to take over the task of Governor General of Australia. The ship in which he went, I can't remember, but I remember we then joined up with this merchant ship, and we just escorted it down to Fremantle in Australia. And she left us there after we'd given three cheers, the usual thing, and we went into Fremantle, and of course that's when we really discovered Down Under. And that's of course where our lads discovered the strength of Australian beer, the strength of the Midi, which is a small glass, and the schooner, which again is smaller than a pint glass. But I can remember our lad saying, gosh, do you call this a pint? We drink pints in Britain, I better have one in each hand. And having one in each hand, found that, well, this is all very well, they might have been smaller glasses of beer, but they were certainly much stronger. And there they were. They were over the weather quite quickly. But Fremantle and the visits to Perth turned out to be a jolly good and thoroughly enjoyable. From there, we did a little foray out into the Indian Ocean. I can't remember for what reason, but I think that's beside the point, because the main thing was we went then from Fremantle around to Sydney, and it's there that we saw the start of the British Pacific Fleet building up. Began because I was in a junior ship, a junior lieutenant commander, that instead of going up into Sydney, our anchorage was at a place called Vaucluse. And I'll never forget going into Vaucluse. If you look at the map of Sydney Harbour, Vaucluse is a very high-class residential area on the south shore of Sydney Harbour, not too far in from the Heads, Sydney Heads. Very expensive houses, etc. And in this little cove of Vaucluse Cove is a tiny beach. And from this tiny beach there's a small jetty, a small wooden jetty. And I can remember going alongside, we tied up alongside in the small jetty with the Ulysses. We were on one side of the jetty, the Ulysses was on the other, and our forepeak, that is right down the bottommost part of the bows, when you got onto the jetty and walked ashore, you could look and see that was about 6 inches above the sand, and you had children playing on the beach with their nannies playing with the sand castles. And it was totally, you think to yourself, good heavens, we've come from a war zone, we've been used to the Mediterranean, we've been used to, all the bombing and banging and crashing around, and we're coming out here now And again, it was almost like utopia. And it was quite incongruous, really, because for the captain to clear lower deck, because it came our periodic, the time had come around, the cycle had come around, for him to read the Articles of War. And I don't suppose, do you know what I mean by these Articles of War?
Well, I've heard of them.
You've heard of them. What is not generally realised is that the army are not, the army and the RAF are sworn men. The army and the RAF swear to serve their king and country, or queen and country, whatever, whereas in the navy you do not swear allegiance. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. So in the navy you're not sworn, but every so often you have the Articles of War where you clear lower deck and the ship's company is called to attention. You off caps, and the captain off caps and tucks his hat under his arm, and he reads the Articles of War. And the Articles of War sets out and states all manner of things and condition and conduct to which you must adhere. The kind of thing that any man who shall absent himself from duty at the time of war in the ship shall be subject to such punishment as death or such as hereafter mentioned. In other words, it sets out quite clearly that though you are not a sworn man and you don't swear for the king's shilling, as it were, nevertheless it is left in no doubt whatever where your allegiance lies, and it is clearly every 6 months put clearly before you. And it was quite incongruous when I look back on this, and this is one thing in my memory, that we cleared lower deck on this little wooden jetty, and there's the captain reading all these things, the horrible things that would be hanged from the yardarm if we was in dereliction of our duty in any way, and yet there were the children playing with sandcastles on this little beach. Quite an interesting little scene. Anyway, we were there in a very idyllic setting, and I think we were there for about a fortnight, and we were there to sample the delights of Sydney, and that was absolutely first class. But then, of course, it all came to an end, and then we gathered together as a fleet, and we all sailed northward to Manus in the Admiralty Island, and that's an island just north of New Guinea, and this is a well-known anchorage which had been taken by the Americans. And when we arrived there, there were an absolute, well, the armada of ships was quite unbelievable. And to our canteen manager, who went ashore, no, there was no shore leave given, but he went ashore for some supplies, and he came back and said how the Americans had cleared out great chunks of jungle and arranged in the streets and all the goodies that went with it, and their chow and all their, you know, dining halls, etc. Anyway, we gathered at Manus until the time came, and then we steamed northward as part then of the British Pacific Fleet, and we were task group 37, if my memory serves me, and our admiral was a vice admiral called Rawlings, and we were part of the assault being taking place on Okinawa. The Americans took the brunt of that attack on Okinawa, and their fleet was either the 7th Fleet under, there was an Admiral Spruance and an Admiral Halsey. When one was in command, it was the 7th Fleet. When the other was in command, it was the 3rd Fleet. We thought at first that there were two separate fleets. In fact, it was the same fleet. But anyway, our function in this Okinawa operation was to knock out airfields on a place called Sakishima Gunto, and to provide also air cover for Americans, etc., around as and where be. And I'll never forget our first encounter with suicide aircraft, and it occurred, oddly enough, on April the 1st. And we were steaming along. Aircraft had gone off, had been fired off, and we had what is known as a CAP, a combat air patrol, was up there. That's keeping an eye over the fleet, as air cover over the fleet. And we were quite near the Indomitable. And I remember we had an air raid warning yellow, and then it turned to red, imminent. We were closed up at action stations, but there's no visible sign of any Japanese attack in the way that we'd had it in the Mediterranean, where the Stukas or Junkers 88 used to come in quite numbers. There's nothing to be seen. And then I can remember again from my position where I used to take up the back of the director on the bridge, looking across towards the Indomitable, and there was an aircraft flying straight towards the Indomitable, and it flew right along low across its flight deck, and it was pursued by two other aircraft. But at first sight it didn't look as if they were pursuing. There were just three aircraft there, one out in front and two others behind, and the front one, as it went across the Indomitable, I can remember the ominous signal saying, "Good God, the commander air won't be very pleased with that pilot doing that across the deck of the carrier." Because as it went and came across the bows of the carrier, it got to the island and it went up in a great big loop, as if it were going to loop the loop, and then dive straight down right onto the deck of the Indomitable. And there's a great flash and a great ball of flame went up, and this was our first experience of a suicide aircraft attack. And of course, at the same time as this is happening, of course, sound being what it is, you could hear then the rat-tat-tat-tat, a machine gun fire coming across the water. And it was the machine gun fire of the two following aircraft, which were our chasing fighters, which were chasing this suicide aircraft. And this was something which quite alien to us, something we had not experienced before. And I must say, it was something which made us sit bolt upright. This was a kind of warfare, an air attack, which we'd not experienced. And I must say that we then began to realize that, unlike the Mediterranean, where you could see them up there coming in at you, or they come out of the sun, whatever, this lot stole in at wave height, then climbed in order to get in their dive, and then just dive straight at you, and that was it. And from this attack, then, we had several during that day, and in fact, one of our chummy ships, the one of our flotilla, the Undaunted, I think she was hit on this. No, she may have been hit later on. But anyway, it was our first experience of suicide aircraft attack, and one, of course, which, well, you don't forget in a hurry, because it's the suddenness of that kind of thing, it's a shock. Our other Sakishima experience was that we went in as a destroyer, that is, and we went in to bombard a little bit around this airfield. We had no resistance at all, and it was just like doing a practice shoot, and everyone was highly pleased with it. We didn't, you know, had no one fire back at us, and we fired our number of rounds, and that was it, and we came away. But another thing which was quite remarkable in this whole thing was that we were now joining up, apart from this actual air attack of suicide aircraft, we were now embarking on a method of operation that we'd not known before, which we'd picked up from the Americans, which had been forced upon them. But this is the matter of staying at sea for long periods of time. And we found that, the whole operation of the first operation against the Sakishima Gunto and this Okinawa thing, support if you like, lasted 3 months, from the day we left Sydney to the time we got back again, we were at sea for a whole 3 months. And it meant that you went to sea and you oiled at sea, ammunition at sea, and you got your food at sea. And the food was frequently in the form of dehydrated cabbage, because in a destroyer, of course, we had to go alongside carriers and hope that they would be kind to us and throw us a loaf or two, because you didn't carry any bread and things like that. You don't bake in destroyers. And we found that the whole thing, their mail at sea too, was quite surprising. But we found this whole thing of fleet train, it was quite interesting, because you would go off into the assault area and carry out whatever operation was necessary, and then after 3 or 4 days come back to this particular area in which was the fleet train comprising the tankers and the fleet auxiliary ships. And the whole thing was magnificently organised. Indeed, mail, air letters would be 7 days of being posted in UK, and you would get it slung across to you in the Pacific. And this is something which was most impressive. The biggest hit of all occurred, the biggest attack that I can remember occurred on VE Day, and that's when, of course, in Europe everyone was celebrating the end of the war, and on our world radio, which was tend to be left on all the time, you could go down below and hear commentary from London, such as I can see I'm in Trafalgar Square now, the crowds are waving and singing, and I can see a sailor up a lamppost, and everybody's feeling very, very merry, and all this sort of thing. And whilst this was going on, we were having the biggest attack we had had of suicide aircraft. And I think it was on that day, it was the Indomitable was hit, and I think the Victorious. Did I say the Indom before? It's the Indefatigable was hit, the first attack at Sakishima. I must correct myself, please, if I may. We went out from out to the Far East with the Indefatigable, not the Indomitable, the Indefatigable. That's it. Oh dear, I've made a clanger there.
Alright, you corrected it.
Indefatigable, that great long name. And it was the Indefatigable that was hit on that very first April, the first day. Now, going back to this, the biggest attack was on that VE day, and it was then, I think, that our Undaunted, our chummy ship, was hit. She had a near miss, actually, but they had about half a dozen killed on it. But the suicide aircraft bung in the water alongside her. But one great thing about our carriers was that though these air attacks were quite vicious, and, well, as you would expect them to be, and they did hit the carriers, and in one case, the Taurus, there was a fire which did go down a bit below decks, our carriers were operating within a relatively short space of time. And this is one thing which surprised the Americans, because I can remember the Ticonderoga, the American carrier, being hit, and she was completely out of action, finished, and they had to get her back, and she barely made it back to Pearl Harbor. But afterwards we found that the main reason lay in the fact that the American carriers had wooden flight decks and were lighter in that respect and carried more aircraft. We had fewer aircraft on our carriers, and but they were steel flight decks. And not that the suicide aircraft bounced off, but it was very nearly that effect. And indeed, they wouldn't go through a aircraft carrier's deck, bomb notwithstanding. And one sad thing, in fact, occurred in that particular attack, or the day after that attack. There were three sub-lieutenants I used to go ashore with in Sydney and see them, and one was a pilot and two were observers. Two were observers in Avengers, and one was a pilot in a Corsair, a fighter. Got his name there, Mackay. Anyway, Norman Taylor was in an Avenger. Anyway, when, and this is the formidable now I'm talking about, when she was hit, the aircraft, the suicide aircraft, hit the end of the flight deck forward, just forward of the bridge of the formidable, and slid along the flight deck, and Mac was in his aircraft sitting to take off, and there's no way he could escape this, and this suicide aircraft just ploughed into the, all the parked aircraft towards the stern of the carrier. Anyway, I didn't know this until it was the following day, when, being a destroyer, you had to fetch and carry for the fleet, we went alongside the formidable. And we were then taking off wounded by this jackstay process, of course, which is now familiar, a thing which became very proficient at doing this. But we were taking off wounded from the formidable, and we were taking them aboard us to take to the hospital ship, the Tichelenka. Please don't ask if it's spelled that. It's a Dutch name, I think. But anyway, over came the wounded, and it was to my surprise and, of course, you know, distress to see that Mac was one of them, and he was badly burned, and I regret to say that he died about 2 days later in the Tichelenka. And that, of course, was quite, you know, made you realise that though we were on top, clearly on top, the war was still not over, but by a long shot. And there was still a lot of uphill work to be done on this. The operation ended, and we got ourselves back into Sydney. And I must say, there again, the organisation was absolutely superb. And you will remember when I was talking about the Prince of Wales and the general unhappiness in that ship, because, of course, you were not told of anything at all. Yours was but to, not to reason why, yours but to do and die, as the saying goes. But when we were in the Pacific, we had little nightly bulletins sent around and were typed out by the ship's writer from signals received, etc., what in fact had been going on during the day, how many aircraft we thought the Japanese we'd destroyed, what we had been doing on the ground, what the American Marines had been doing ashore, that sort of thing. So you were kept fully up to date and briefed on what was going on. So when we got back to Sydney, the organisation we felt was one in which we are very much a part now, and you felt here now that at least, you know, you're almost at your height of your powers, and I suppose we were then really as a fighting navy. And when we got back to Sydney, this, of course, was truly put to the test, because when we drew up alongside, and I think we went up to Woolloomooloo on this occasion, we were privileged there, we found that we had a shore repair party came down, and we were told almost literally, as it were, to shove off, and we were given like 3 and 4 days recreation up in Katoomba and places like that in the Blue Mountains of Sydney. And shore leave was very, very liberal. And one thing was quite surprising. Being at sea for 3 months and in a destroyer, the longest walking distance that you have, I suppose, is about from here to that wall, which is, what, about 25 feet. This is by the torpedo tubes. And, of course, you've got to walk along the back of the torpedo tubes, because when you go to sea in a destroyer, torpedo tubes are always trained outboard, ready for firing. And you have the forward ones probably changed out, trained outboard to starboard. And the port four, the port, the after four, would be trained to be, you know, to be fired over the port side. So there was limited walking distance you could do at one hit. And though you used to do your recreation of walking up and down in this very confined distance, it meant that when we got back into Sydney after our first operation, I can remember going to the cinema. Because again, you see, the pub shut at 6 o'clock, the Battle of Beer was on at Sydney. And I can remember walking from Woolloomooloo up into Sydney, which is not no great great distance. And next day I felt my legs ached as if I'd run a marathon. It was quite surprising. But anyway, we were in Sydney then for a fortnight. So you in harbour for a fortnight with 3 months' pay. So you can well imagine, again, we're in a kind of utopia. At the end of that fortnight, we then put to sea for the final assault on Japan. And this involved, again, exactly the similar kind of thing, going first of all to Manus. We were sidetracked in the Urania to Ulithi. And I can remember going to Ulithi, which is part of the truck, the group of islands which had been previously Japanese. And I can remember going and looking at this atoll surrounded by a great big lagoon. And this lagoon was an enormous number of American ships. I don't know for what reason. I don't remember now to this day why we dropped in there. But it's just one of my impressions, again, of islands and without Dorothy and Lemur. Anyway, we joined up the fleet for our final assault on Japan. And my memories, of course, was that life was always one of dawn action stations and dusk action stations, interspersed between continual being either closed up at action stations or in defence watches. But dawn action stations were always quite a revelation, as it were, in that, as I said to you, we were well informed now, because we would have had our bulletins of the night before. We would have been told what the likely targets were going to be the next day, so you were kept quite briefed of what we were looking to try to do next day and where the aircraft were going to go, that sort of thing. And it became quite a routine. And it was quite something to get up in the morning in the dark and close up at action stations, at dawn action stations. And out of the gloom, you would see the carriers there and the aircraft gathering, and off they go at dawn. And they would go off, one turning to port, one to starboard, absolutely efficient. And this whole lot gathering in one great big air fleet and going off to Japan to attack the Japanese mainland. And again, of course, the Americans had it so well organized that if any aircraft were downed, were shot down,